Ani, and welcome to Bombsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. Attawapiskat is in third-party management after its cry for help amidst a housing crisis, and one community member says a housing solution can solve much of what ails the community. The National Aboriginal AIDS Awareness Week campaign has just kicked off. Laxol First Nation has been making investments into its own community, and a university student is working at combating invasive species with Indigenous plants, and growth for an Aboriginal-owned company isn't slowing down soon. All these stories, plus great tunes, all coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. Attawapiskat is now in third-party management. The federal conservatives have taken over the financial management of the community after its call for help in early November. A state of emergency was declared in the northwestern Ontario community of 1800. The Red Cross has also responded to the crisis campaign launched by Timmins James Bay MP Charlie Angus. The organization brought sleeping bags, sweaters, and other items to help many of the residents keep warm with the onset of winter. Rosie Kustachin, volunteer in the community, and has devoted the past several years to obtaining aid for the community through organization True North Aid. She says there are many issues that plague the community, including social and mental health issues. Kustachin says addressing the housing situation would go a long way towards resolving other issues in the community.
A lot of things are really empty here. A lot. I don't even know where to begin. For sure. The number one thing for me, my experience with when I was homeless, for me, it's a house. Number one is getting the house. And after that, after when you're all settled in at your house, you're happy, and they just offer programs that are like to teach us. Some people don't know parenting skills. Some people don't know about how to conserve energy, stuff like that. Some kind of awareness like that. So it helps a family to help them out to be more, need resources like that. We also need counseling. Counseling is very important too. They should offer that all the time.
CBC also reports the federal housing allocation for the community is almost $600,000 and the cost of building a new home is $250,000. The community also has just over $10 million in trust from De Beers, and it's been estimated that about $84 million is needed to build and repair homes in the community. And it's also been reported that the community has been under co-management system with the federal government over the past 5 years. Human bones have been found at the site of a former Mohawk Institute in Brantford, which is now the current Woodland Cultural Center. A spokesman told the Brantford Expositor that the bones belonged to First Nations children who were students at the residential school, which operated at the site until 1970. Some of the bones have been sent away for forensic DNA analysis, and a search for documents from the London Diocese of the Anglican Church has been requested. Two men are now facing jail time after being convicted of poaching eagles on Vancouver Island. The Cowichan Valley Citizen reports the two men had fought the charges against them, claiming it was their Aboriginal right to possess eagle parts and that undercover officers entrapped them into killing and selling the birds. Jerome Seymour has been sentenced to 48 days in jail and his cousin William Seymour to 9 days in jail. Jerome was convicted of 16 counts of killing and selling 10 bald eagles, two swans and one kingfisher between January and April 2006. William was convicted of 3 of 5 counts, and the two will serve their sentences on weekends. December 1st marked World AIDS Day, and it was also the kickoff to National Aboriginal AIDS Awareness Week 2011. The Canadian Aboriginal AIDS Network campaign theme for this year is It Takes a Whole Community to Support Change. Art Zokel is the chair of the board of directors of CAN. Zokel says he hopes the campaign will reduce stigma through education and awareness.
People who are living with HIV and AIDS, we are experiencing sometimes some difficulties by some of our communities, in supporting people who are living with HIV and AIDS, right? Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do is trying to make our communities aware that it takes everybody in our community to start talking about HIV and AIDS and to be accepted. accepting our community members back home.
The HIV/AIDS infection rate among Aboriginal people is 3.6 times higher than other Canadians. Zocal attributes several reasons to the high rate.
There's a number of reasons. It has to do with our economic status in our communities and what people have been through. Goes right back to colonization, residential school, you know, all of the things that we've been experiencing in our communities. And sometimes what we call that is our Aboriginal reality. That's where we're at in terms of, you know, what's happening in our communities out there. So that puts people, you know, at risk, you know, for HIV.
Zocal says that communities can implement more support programs for people living with HIV/AIDS, and he says CAN provides a community readiness model. The Anishinaabeg Nation is calling on the province to work on fetal alcohol spectrum disorder prevention. Deputy Grant Council Chief Glenn Hare says the disorder costs the country over $4 billion every year and is the number one cause of birth defects in the world. But he says there is little being done about it. The Deputy Grand Chief made his remarks at the start of the second Anishinaabeg G7 FASD conference this week. And Angela Recollet, Executive Director of Shkagamekw Health Center in Sudbury, says more resources need to be put into services for individuals over the age of 6. In Manitoba, there's an ongoing power struggle in a First Nation with 2 chiefs and 2 councils. The Winnipeg Free Press reports the community, Roseau River First Nation, is in third-party management, but the trouble began when the First Nation's Custom Council removed Terry Nelson from power and set another election, which Kent Henry won. Now, both men claim they are the chiefs of the band. So, right now, banks don't recognize either administration and neither does Aboriginal and Northern Affairs. Now, both chiefs have asked Ottawa for a resolution. Lac Seul First Nation in northwestern Ontario has invested its own funding into the community. Chief Clifford Bull says $16 million is being used for road infrastructure, a convention center, and seed money for economic development projects. Bull says the available funding came from money won in a court battle.
We had an outstanding grievance against Canada regarding timber, so we put forth a claim and we went to court. So we won a favorable decision in court to the tune of $27 million. So we used a portion of that to do these projects.
Other investments into planned projects include a commercial wild rice farm, a training facility, and a long-term care center. Carla Marsalis is a member of Batchewana Bay First Nation, and she's a student at Lake Superior State University in Michigan, and she's participating in an environmental project to bring back Indigenous flora and fauna to combat invasive species. Marcella says it's important to restore the natural environment.
So I wish to raise awareness, you know, that it's crucial and really beneficial to restore and rehabilitate our natural ecosystems that have experienced such habitat loss and undergone fragmentation, you know, a lot of human behaviors and principles and practices that we go about are very ecologically destructive and detrimental.
Marcella says introducing Indigenous plants will, over time, diminish the invasive species. Marcella says examples of common invasive species include St. John's wort, Scots pine, and purple loosestrife. Well, business is booming for an Aboriginal-owned and operated company. The company is Manitoba Mucklucks. Sean McCormick is the president of that company, and he says the company just keeps growing.
We are growing double-digit growth every year for the past 3 years since we launched the brand, and doesn't seem like it's slowing down at all. Crazy demand, especially this time of year.
The company sells mucklucks and moccasins manufactured in Canada. The company also has another branch in the company to sustain First Nation artisans who create mucklucks and moccasins by hand. It's called the Story Boot Project and is the company's way of giving back to the community. McCormick says the project helps remote artisans keep the craft alive.
So what we're trying to do is help them sell them for what they're worth, and that we hope will be part of, you know, helping the individual from an economic standpoint and helping the art form remain viable so that it gets passed along, because it is something that someone can do and doesn't cost them money. They can actually make money doing it. And that's my strong belief that that's one of our responsibilities. I say this a lot. We borrowed a lot of our designs, or all of our designs. You know, our designs are thousands of years old, certainly with a modern twist, but we really borrowed these, and it's our... we have a debt to repay that way.
Celebrities such as Megan Fox, Madonna, and Kate Moss have been seen wearing the Manitoba Mucklucks brand. The City of Ottawa's Library and Archives may be undergoing a name change. One of the names under consideration is that of the former Lieutenant Governor of Ontario, James Bartleman. During his time in office, the member of Mijikenang First Nation launched a book drive and collected over 1 million books for First Nations and First Nations schools throughout the province. The proposal for the name change goes before Ottawa City Council on December 14th. And that's your National Aboriginal News. Day with Disappearing Humans. December 1st marked World AIDS Day, and that was also the kickoff to National Aboriginal AIDS Awareness Week 2011. And Art Zokol is the chair of the board of directors of the Canadian Aboriginal AIDS Network, and he spoke with Bomsida.
Aboriginal AIDS Awareness Week in Canada is always from December 1st through to December 5th in Canada. The rest of Canada is celebrating AIDS Awareness Week, which starts the latter part of November and ends on December 1st. So ours starts on December 1st and ends on December 5th.
So why a different week?
I think what we wanted to attempt to do was, you know, for our communities, so that we'd have an opportunity to get the message out to our communities in a timely manner about the different themes that we have each year. So for example, this year, our theme is it takes the whole community to support change in terms of HIV and AIDS.
Okay, well, tell me more about that theme.
Okay, so people who are living with HIV and AIDS, we are experiencing sometimes some difficulties by some of our communities, you know, in supporting people who are living with HIV and AIDS, right? Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do is trying to make our communities aware that it takes everybody in our community to start talking about HIV and AIDS and to be accepting our community members back home.
And so that's, is that difficult for people to come out and say they have HIV AIDS or is, you know, is that something that's known?
Yeah, there is challenges around people disclosing their HIV AIDS status to their communities, and some Aboriginal people experience stigma and discrimination in their community. And so our event hopefully will acknowledge that we need to change what's happening in our communities, in First Nations communities, Métis communities, and in Inuit communities across the country, to be more supportive of people who are living with HIV and AIDS.
Okay.
And so, actually, as an example, we have a website, which is www.AboriginalAIDSAwareness.com. And on there is a message from Sean Atleo, who is the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. And it's a public service announcement, and our community members can have a look at that and see what the National Chief has to say in terms of, you know, supporting people who are living with HIV and AIDS.
And so what are the HIV and AIDS infection rates of Aboriginal people?
The infection rates are quite high in our community and continue to be in terms of the overall infection rate. So, for example, Aboriginal people are 3.6 times more likely in Canada to get HIV and AIDS versus non-Aboriginal Canadians. And so, you know, the infection rates continue to be an issue in our community, and we need to get the education out there about how people can prevent contracting HIV.
And so do we know why infection rates are so high?
There's a number of reasons. It has to do with our economic status in our communities and what people have been through. Goes right back to colonization, residential school, you know, all of the things that we've been experiencing in our communities. And sometimes what we call that is our Aboriginal reality. That's where we're at in terms of, you know, what's happening in our communities out there. So that puts people, you know, at risk, you know, for HIV.
And so what are communities doing right now about this?
Well, for example, you know, I think if I use Ontario, for example, there is a group called the Ontario First Nations HIV/AIDS Education Circle, and they have a group of people that provide workshops on HIV prevention and awareness to First Nations communities in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
And my agency, the one I do in Toronto, is called Two-Spirited People of the First Nations. And we provide support services to Aboriginal people who are living within the greater Toronto area, and we develop resources that are used right across the country to help people to understand, you know, the issues that are faced by Two-Spirit people and HIV and AIDS.
Hmm.
And so there's another group in Ontario that is the Ontario HIV AIDS Strategy, and they have a number of workers situated throughout the province that do outreach and referral for people who are living with HIV and AIDS, sort of like in areas around London and Sudbury, Thunder Bay, Ottawa, and other urban centers, and, you know, in rural areas as well.
And so what more can communities do?
Well, I think what more communities can do is to, come in with programs and services that help to support Aboriginal people living with HIV and AIDS. So one of the things that the Canadian Aboriginal AIDS Network has done over the last couple of years is a community readiness model in terms of looking at, say, for example, harm reduction, right? So when our communities are looking at doing harm reduction activities, what kind of activities do they need to do inside, you know, their communities to be more accepting of people who are living with HIV and AIDS? And actually, I mentioned the website, AboriginalAIDSAwareness.com. On there is an activities guide for communities. If they don't know what to do during Aboriginal AIDS Awareness Week, we have some suggestions for them to have a look at and see if they can do some activities in their community.
That was Art Zokol, chair of the board of directors of the Canadian Aboriginal AIDS Network. Attawapiskat has been in the headlines all week long. Canada has learned about the housing crisis, and the federal government has taken over the financial handling of the community, placing it in third-party management. And Rose Kustachin is a community member and volunteer in her community, and she spoke with Bomsida about her experiences at home.
For the last couple of days, I have been traveling with different people, traveling on a vehicle with media and some journalists and people coming into the community. Yesterday, the Red Cross came and arrived with donations in the afternoon and the evening. There was some people that came in, like Charlie Angus and a woman there, Nicole, I believe. Last couple of days, there's just been a lot of activity, people coming into the community. Red Cross, the donations, the stuff came in yesterday on the plane. I believe there were blankets and I'm not sure what else is in there, and generators probably. So today, I found it's kind of quiet and stuff, and it's kind of warm today.
And so, and that's all because of a housing crisis in your community. And can you describe the housing situation there?
The housing situation here in Attawapiskat, there's a lot of overcrowding. There's a lot of families living in a house, maybe three or four families living in a house. Like I said, it's overcrowding. There's also an issue with the housing because the houses are really old here, built sometime 1970s, and a lot of them are really deteriorating and they've been condemned. That's why that's happening in our community.
And so how has the housing crisis directly affected you, Rosie?
Oh, for me, it has affected me for the housing crisis. Let me just put, share some a story. How I was back in 2000. Sometime 2005 and 2006, I was having a housing crisis myself because of my floor caved in. Sometime in January and February, in the cold winter time. So my house was built in 1970s. It's been really, it was deteriorating after my floor collapsed. So what we did, we had a media came in, and I was kind of embarrassed about my house, how I was living with my children, but I had to speak up because I wanted a safe place, a very healthy environment for my children. They were small at the time, and my son was born with a heart murmur, eczema, and asthma. So for me, I blame it on the housing, the health, like I said, the health condition, and I blame it on the contamination also. It could be from the contamination and the mold too, because my house was very moldy. It's really old. So for me, I'm lucky enough to have a house. They only built two houses that time, two emergency houses, when they built my house after it was demolished.
So I wanted to ask you, what do you think it would take for your community to be healthy?
Well, there's a lot of things that are really empty here. A lot. I don't even know where to begin. For sure, the number one thing for me, from my experience with when I was homeless, for me, is a house. Number one is getting the house, and after that, after when you're settled in at your house, you're happy, and they should offer programs that are like to teach us. Some people don't know parenting skills. Some people don't know about how to conserve energy, stuff like that. Some kind of awareness like that to help a family, to help them out to be more, to need resources like that. We also need counseling. Counseling is very important too. They should offer that all the time, either traditional or any form of traditional or counseling. That's very important. The other thing is I think that's very important. There's a lot of stuff that are happening here, even the water too. There's a lot of things that major overhaul that needs to be done here. I don't even know where to begin, but I know for sure a warm house.
That was Rosie Kustachin, a community member in Attawapiskat, and Chief Teresa Spence was unavailable for comment. Now here's Missy Knott with No Man Begins.
Till the drums are in sync with his heart. No man begins to dream till creation of the sun and the moonlight beam. No man begins to climb up the mountain, leaving someone behind. No man attests his fate, stays his path without creator and mate. No man begins to fly till he learns. Catch his dream that goes by. Till he knows, till he breathes, learns to bend, stops to see. Till he cries, till he gives, till he learns how to dance, then he lives. No man begins until he has come to give up all of his will. No man can break the night till he stands before the Spirit. No man begins his best till his soul becomes a vision quest. Till he knows, till he breathes, learns to bend, stops to see. Till he cries, till he gives, till he learns how to dance, then he lives.
Men are only men, they aren't perfect, and they aren't perfect. Men are only men, they aren't perfect, and they aren't perfect, and they aren't perfect. Men are only men, the vision presses on, forever making it forever worth it.
First Nation in northwestern Ontario has invested its own funding into the community. Chief Clifford Bull says $16 million is being used for road infrastructure, a convention center, and seed money for economic development projects.
We're doing two major projects this past summer, and one of the major ones is the road project. That's to the tune of $6 million, road upgrade, to ensure safety for members. And the unique thing about Lac Seul is it has three communities under Lac Seul, and we're kind of very far apart, so there's a lot of road networks that have to be fixed up, and we have access to all three through roads and bridges. And the other one we're doing is our arena project. It's a Allstate Conference Center attached to it, and then that's also around, well, that's a little bit more. That one's going to be about $8 million, and that's hopefully set for completion in the year 2012, August.
So the press release stated that about $16 million of your own funds went into those projects. And So where did the funding come from?
We had an outstanding grievance against Canada regarding timber. So we put forth a claim, and we went to court. So it, we won a favorable decision in court to the tune of $27 million. So we used a portion of that to do these projects.
And I also understand that you have some other projects for the community plans in respect to commercial rice farm, a training facility, and a few other things. And why don't you tell us about those?
Very much so. Yes, we have plans for a rice harvesting business. Back in early 20s and 30s, there was a flood here, and the rice fields were devastated, and along with homes, basically the livelihood was destroyed. So we wanted to reestablish the practice, that cultural component of the First Nation touching aspect into the community. The other one is the training center. We bought we were able to acquire a old school adjacent to the community here, and we wanted to put that towards a mining school of excellence to take advantage of all the mineral activity that's in northern Ontario, and hopefully train some of the northern community members from various communities to become miners. And also we had some money come in for equity fund to look at businesses, how we can help private entrepreneurs establish businesses in the community, whether it be in mineral or preferably mineral businesses, but we're looking at all aspects. And the other thing we're doing is we're fixing the Pelican Falls Road, and that road is reached to a high school. And actually today we're having a little bit of a rally at the site with the students coming out with signs thanking the chiefs, the district chiefs from Silico, who are supporting this initiative. The First Nations people are going to be putting in their own money to do this project. It's around $130,000. And there's been a dispute on the road, and the jurisdiction of the road is still in question. So the nature of it is we wanted to ensure that the safety of the students go there using the road is addressed. And it was deemed the worst road in Canada last year, so by, I believe it was Canadian Automobile Association. So we want to make sure that the road is fixed and the students travel safe to school each day, and people that use it. And the ambulance won't even go down that road because of the safety factor. So we're going to be doing some work on that road in the next couple of weeks.
So with respect to the training facility, Chief Bull, have you had discussions with any of the mining companies that they would look at your community for training?
Actually, we're involved with Goldcorp, a company, and they've committed $500,000 to this mining school of excellence, and we have the facility, like I said, and it's just a matter of doing a curriculum and doing some preliminary work in that end.
Okay.
And we've been in a discussion with Goldcorp now for 4 years. We continue to still sit at the table.
That was Laxalt First Nation Chief Clifford Bull. Carla Marcellus is a member of Batchewana Bay First Nation, and she's also a student at Lake Superior State University in Michigan. She's participating in an environmental project to bring back Indigenous flora and fauna to combat invasive species.
The program that I'm in right now, it's called the Human Environment, and what it entails is to, you know, promote and design and implement a sustainable landscaping project. Well, not necessarily landscaping, that's what I went about doing, but just sustainability on Lake Superior State University campus.
So how are you going about this project?
Well, how I put everything together was, you know, a lot of footwork. I've talked to public relations on campus to help me raise awareness of what I was doing. I've got a lot of opinions and suggestions from faculty members at Lake State who are very helpful. Mostly I've spoke with dendrologists, ornithologists, botanists, of course.
So what is invasive species do to the environment, Carla?
Well, invasive species, why they're such an issue is that because they have no immediate threat, as they would in their own natural environments, they're then able to establish themselves and choke out our native species, if you will.
And so is this something that you want to bring back to your community?
Of course. I wish to raise awareness, you know, that it's crucial and really beneficial to restore and rehabilitate our natural ecosystems that have experienced such habitat loss and undergone fragmentation. You know, a lot of human behaviors and principles and practices that we go about are very ecologically destructive and detrimental. So by bringing back these species, because, you know, they're so adapted to their surroundings, they will actually, you know, over time, diminish the species, the invasives that are there. And also, you know, they improve soil stability and water and air quality, too.
Would you happen to know what invasive species is around, like around Sault Ste. Marie, for example?
Yeah, sure. Well, I can start with some of the herbs most commonly known that people would know would be maybe spotted knapweed, common St. John's wort, there's maybe a wild parsnip, some of the trees and shrubs too, Norway maple, there's Scots pine, a lot of ornamental type species we're seeing. Another common one is purple loosestrife.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, other people are working on such thing as trying to eliminate them as well.
That was Carla Marcellus from Batchewan Bay First Nation. Now here's Stevie Salas with Bring It Easy.
You know me, I'm the super unknown.
Muckluks, an Aboriginal-owned and run company, and it's seeing a boom time, and the company president, Sean McCormick, doesn't see that it will slow down soon. So here's Sean telling us about the company.
Well, Manitoba Muckluks is a Canadian Aboriginally-owned manufacturer of Aboriginal footwear, muckluks, moccasins, mitts, that sort of stuff. We sell to retailers and distributors in, I think we're in 23 countries now, certainly Canada being our strongest market, but we're basically global at this point. We have approximately 50 employees spread over three locations. We have our head office in manufacturing in Winnipeg. We have warehousing facilities in Winnipeg, and then our sales and global sales and brand office is just outside of Ottawa in Gatineau, Quebec. And that's where all our customer service takes place. And, yeah, we've been selling Muckluks under the Manitoba brand name for about 4 years to the gift and souvenir industry as well as the footwear industry.
Well, that's interesting. And so what have sales been like?
We are growing double-digit growth every year for the past 3 years since we launched the brand, and doesn't seem like it's slowing down at all. Crazy demand, especially this time of year, for our outdoor products like our Vibram Soul Muckluck, and then our indoor products too. We make a pretty big line of both indoor and outdoor footwear.
So I was cruising around your website and I noticed one of the tabs called the Story Boot Project. And why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. The Story Boot Project is something that we've been working on in some aspects since I started. Basically, what the Story Boot Project is that we take handmade mucklucks made in the old ways, generally by elders, First Nations people on generally remote northern reserves. And what we do is we help them sell them for what they're really worth as individual pieces of art. And what we hope to do is what we've seen happening is there's less and less people making these. And part of the reason is it's not an economically viable art form. A lot of people don't get what these mucklucks or moccasins are really worth when you add in the immense amount of skilled labor that goes into them and the cost of the materials. So what we're trying to do is help them sell them for what they're worth, and that we hope will be part of helping the individual from an economic standpoint and helping the art form remain viable so that it gets passed along, because it is something that someone can do and doesn't cost them money. They can actually make money doing it. And that's my strong belief that that's one of our responsibilities. I say this a lot. We borrowed a lot of our designs, or all of our designs. Our designs are thousands of years old, certainly with a modern twist, but we really borrowed these, and it's our... we have a debt to repay that way. So the Story Boot Project's one of the ways that we can do that.
Okay, and I also noticed there's a significant price gap between the Story Boot Project mucklucks and moccasins compared to the other things on your site.
The Story Boot boots are one of a kind, individual handmade, so they range anywhere from, say, $900 to $1,500 for a pair of mucklucks. So whereas our boots are made, we're making 300 or 400 pairs of mucklucks a day. A Story Boot Project pair of boots will take someone a month to make, an individual. So there's obviously a big price difference. And the really cool thing about the Story Boot Project is whatever we sell those mucklucks for, 100% of the proceeds go to the artist. So, they're getting paid what these boots are really worth as works of art, exactly what they are.
So how are those ones selling then?
They're doing well. We like to sell more. The project is really just getting... I guess you'd call it its hard launch. We've been working on this for a number of years, just sort of setting it up and figuring out how it's going to work. We really do believe the best way to sell the Story Boots is telling the story online through our website and getting the traffic to the website and directing people to these individual works of art and getting them to the artist and whatnot. And because it is a big commitment to pay $1,000 for a pair of boots, but once you read the stories and see the beautiful quality and the workmanship that goes into them, it becomes a much easier sell.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and you'll care for them much better if they're priced that. And so I wanted another thing, is there a difference between male and female footwear?
I would say, the sizing is different, obviously, and the styling. 95% of our sales are to women, ultimately. We do have some men's items, and we do have some items that are unisex, but it's mostly at this point focused on women and women's footwear. We see, as we expand, we see expanding the men's line, but like I said, like 95% of what we do now is definitely for women.
And so I have another question. Who is wearing your footwear?
Well, I like to think lots of smart, beautiful people all over Canada and the world are wearing them, but you know, we have that celebrity hook that's starting to become a bit of a, I guess it's a bonus for the company. Megan Fox was recently spotted wearing them. We've had celebrities, Kate Moss, Madonna, many celebrities have worn them in the past or are wearing them now. But what I would say is really, you know, bringing attention to the brand and really fueling our growth. It's really an organic growth, so it's based on the fact that these boots are not only beautiful, fashionable, but they work. They're really functional. They're super comfortable, and really an iconic Canadian piece of footwear. I don't know how much more Canadian these could get. You know, an Aboriginal design by an Aboriginal company. So I think that's really what's fueling the growth. And all the celebrity stuff is cool, but. The growth and the brand awareness is really, I think, based on those organic fundamentals.
That was Sean McCormick, president of Manitoba Mucklucks. You've been listening to Bomb Sida with Jennifer Ashwasagay. Bomb Sida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomb Sida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombseda.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bombseda.